Question for you. How important is heritage to you? Do you consider it to be a part of your ancestry or your identity? Another question for you. What if your heritage was within reach, but it was being smothered by evil and violent acts? Could you deal with that? That's something my next guest has lived with and, more importantly, strongly responded to. While born here in the U.S., his family relocated to Iran, where the Islamic Revolution made attacking freedoms of all kinds a priority. He joins us to offer his insight into what the Iranian people are experiencing and trying to survive, and for them, what's a multi-front battle. His upcoming book, where he tells his personal story, is Passport to Freedom, From Tehran to Triumph. He's also chairman of the board of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, as well as founder and chair of the Sympatico Foundation. Dr. Nizam Musaghi, how are you today, doctor?
I'm very well, Chris. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and certainly making your life an open book with your experiences. Two websites, we do have them at the homepage, too, IranHRDC.org and thesympatico.org. Find out more about those organizations that Dr. Musaghi is related to. Let us start with your story because, as I said, you were born in the U.S., family relocated into Iran. At what point, at what stage was the revolution underway? And that also brings about the question for the person listening, I'm sure, as it does for me. In a place where that Islamic revolution was happening, why would, other than for heritage and family, would one want to go back there?
I was born in the U.S. during the time when my mother was doing her pediatric residency in New York. And her residency finished in 1976. At the time, I was an infant. And my parents opted to move back to Iran because they wanted to help develop their nation and be productive members of society. 1976 is about 3 years before the 1979 revolution. And so at the time, they did not know that the revolution was about to happen. Iran was an island of safety and security. It was a place where Iranians had, and they still continue to have, a significant affinity to. So they went back not knowing what would happen. And, of course, their lives were upended by the 1979 Islamic Revolution, of course, the war that followed with Iraq for 8 years afterwards. If you ask my parents, my mom has passed, but you ask my father, he would still say that he has no regrets for going back because he felt a calling to be there and be able to contribute to Iran as his homeland, but unfortunately the circumstances really significantly restricted their ability to do that.
Talk about what it was like coming of age in an environment like that, because if you're an infant 3 years before, around 4 or 5 years old is when everything started to happen or fall apart, as one, whatever way one wants to term it. So talk about those early years of your awareness, and was what was going on around you just, for lack of a better phrase, just seemed to be normalcy?
Absolutely. One of the things that really is prominent in my mind is that there is a duality of existence. There is what you could say in the outside world that would be safe and would not get you into trouble, and there is the level of free speech that you could have at home. And the two of them were very discordant. You could at home be critical of the Islamic regime. You could understand that, you know, even in private parties where parents are having conversations, they would be very critical of the leadership and the decisions that they would make, such as the raiding of the U.S. embassy or the policies that led to the start of the Iraq war, for example. But they would always tell you that our private conversations are never to be repeated outside. There were attempts by even school principals and teachers to try to understand who would be against the revolution through extracting or exacting information from children. So I remember a time when a teacher walked into the classroom with what appeared to be a shot glass, a very small glass in his hand, and said, "Hey, whose parents drink water out of cups like this?" And a few kids left to their feet. They're like, "Mine do." And so just so that they would know whose homes would have alcohol in them, for example. But we generally had to be very careful with the expression that the walls have ears, that if you say anything to expose your family, they could be in trouble, your home could be raided, and their parents could be taken in for interrogation and sometimes detained for a long time without any sort of explanation. And the kinds of security charges that would level against ordinary citizens, such as waging war against God or spreading corruption on earth, could carry the death penalty. So you have to be very careful within this very significant and heavy security environment.
Dr. Nizam Asagi, his upcoming book, Passport to Freedom, From Tehran to Triumph. He's chairman of the board of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, founder and chair of the Sympatico Foundation, IranHRDC.org, thesympatico.org, the respective websites. We have them at a homepage as well, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. What you just said, Doctor, brings me to, I think, an important point people listening here in America certainly need to know and understand. It's well accepted and understood that when it comes to human rights, Iran historically has been horrendous. But human rights violations in Iran don't begin and end with wrongful imprisonment. It gets a great deal more violent than that, doesn't it?
Absolutely does. They would significantly restrict freedom of speech, and those who dare to speak will face the most severe of consequences, and they could have the seizure of their assets. They could have years or decades that they would have to spend in prison. And the problem is not just with the people whose rights are violated, but every one of these people has families. And you can imagine the generational trauma and impact it would have on the children and on spouses, and the economic disaster that they would have to face when their loved ones are taken away or even in some circumstances executed for basically not falling in line.
Help us understand the Iranian people right now, because human nature be what it is, you're constrained, you're feel abandoned maybe even by the world around you, and you're left to yourself. We saw the uprising advance rather significantly now over a decade ago when Barack Obama was president here in the U.S., and we failed to give it any kind of meaningful support other than a few days after. It was, well, nice try, hope you have better luck next time. But today, in the here and now, when the new leadership makes a public appearance of any kind, as whenever they have, the few times in light of everything happening, the people come out and cheer. Is that because, much like an abused spouse falls in love with their captor to try to have at least one more day of peace?
Yeah. So like any other society, Iran is not a monolithic society. The people certainly have different opinions and beliefs. The general understanding, and of course we have to understand that it's very difficult to do any scientific polling in a country that is so closed and does not allow any foreign journalists to be present. But the Iranian people generally are very determined. They have one of the highest literacy rates in the region, especially in the Middle East, with women who, in some places in neighboring countries, for example, Afghanistan, where education is significantly restricted, in Iran, now for a couple of decades, Iranian women have been the majority graduates of universities. And so Iran is very significantly wired with the internet, except now for the past month where internet has been completely shut off. They know how the rest of the world lives. They are very significantly secular, which is very unusual for that region of the world. And but there is also a small faction of sycophants and sympaths of the Islamic Republic. There have been some Twitter-based polls that put that number somewhere around 11 to 12%. So the propaganda that comes out of the regime when they shut down the internet for everybody else is they create a rally with people holding pictures of the Ayatollah to try to give to the world an impression that the Iranians are also happy with the leadership and with the Islamic Republic. But from all of what we can see, The majority of Iranians do not stand with this Islamic Republic. The majority of the Iranians are freedom-seeking people who wish to have normal lives, basic human rights, and the ability to thrive, not just survive.
Last question. We have to wrap up here, but given how the leadership of the country seems to be getting more and more radical, for all intents and purposes, it's the IRGC who is running things now, and they make the previous leadership look like cooperative cohabitants of a nation. What's the realistic expectation of what's to come once the expected military actions end in another 2 to 4 weeks from most expectations? You know, what's next for Iran and her people?
Here, of course, nobody has a crystal ball about what's going to happen. The one thing that I can say is that I am in touch significantly with people who happen to get online for brief periods and send messages through the Telegram messaging app, that there are majority of people that talk to me say that they are more afraid of the wounded wolf left behind, that's the Islamic Republic, than the missiles of Israel and the U.S. And that tells a lot about the repressive nature of this regime, that if they happen to stay in power, the only people to whom they can show their power is the people, and they can brutalize them, and they can cut the Iran from the rest of the world through internet shutouts and all of these things. And so the realistic expectation, I am not certain of whether some version of the Islamic Republic that's more moderate is going to stay, whether there's going to be a collapse and regime change, for example, which I think is the desire of the majority of Iranians, or whether Iran will sink into something that becomes closer to North Korea and completely cut out from the rest of the world, really remains to be seen. But here, the people of Iran are hopeful that because their plight has now aligned with U.S. and Israeli policies, because Iran has also been destabilizing the region, that hopefully a significant attenuation of power in Iran will create an opportunity for them to take to the streets and take back their own government and be more involved in, you know, the self-determination can return to the people.
That would indeed be a blessing, with organized resistance that can accomplish as opposed to just push back and fight. Looking forward to Dr. Mirzaghi's book later on this year, Passport to Freedom, From Tehran to Triumph. Visit the site of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. It's very informative and will give you a better understanding of exactly what the people of Iran have to contend with and try to survive. It's iranhrdc.org. He's also founder and chair of the Sympatico Foundation, the Sympatico.org, that website. Dr. Nizam Mirzaghi, thanks so much for telling your story, helping us better understand that there's a human side to what we're going through and seeing, not just political and military, and you help us appreciate the human side of this whole thing a lot more. Thanks for being here today.
Chris, thank you so much for the opportunity.